This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good, good. How you doing?
Doing pretty good. You know, today is our episode about the ego trap. Mm-hmm. And as I was researching for this episode, we have a couple of questions about the ego trap, which, this entire episode will be dedicated to the ego trap. And so hopefully that will answer these questions. And if we don't answer the questions, then we'll go over them next week as a follow-up. But as I was researching this episode, it turns out that there was a really interesting article that came into the news a bit ago. And this was a young man he's a runner, and he was running in the mountain somewhere, and a little baby mountain lion attacked him.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out this runner happened to kill the mountain lion in this attack.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very cool to read these before we found out the entire story. The articles were runner kills mountain lion with his bare hands, runner suffocates mountain lion. It's all these really cool, sensational articles. And then a couple of days later, as the runner recovers, I mean, you see his face and he's bloody, bruised. He finally recovers and has a press conference. And he talks about what's going on and what exactly happened and how he actually killed this mountain lion. And it was really interesting to see exactly what you've talked about before in the ego trap, where this exact scenario where the young hunter who's maybe not as capable accidentally kills a wildebeest and then spins a big story. But in this case, he didn't spin a big story. He was actually a pretty honest guy. So he gets out of this press conference, and the first thing you notice is the guy is small. You know, he's not a big stature at all. And it's funny because, Dr. Lyle, in the previous episode, you mentioned how to get the audience on your side by using some self-effacing humor. So here's what the runner said as the first thing in this press conference.
Hey, everybody. Just a show of hands, who all is disappointed that I'm not, in fact, Chuck Norris? Yeah, I know. For everybody who thought I was a big, beefy guy. So
right away, this guy is smarter than most.
Yeah.
He's a little more self-aware. I like it.
Yeah.
So he goes and tells this story of what exactly happened, how he said it was luck of the draw. I mean, he's so honest about this. I was incredibly impressed. You know, he talks about his story, how mountain lion was just a baby. It was like a younger mountain lion and tried to fight him, tried to bite him. And he happened to just step on his neck, took a rock and, you know, killed the mountain lion. And so these reporters who had just written articles about how this savage beast, you know, was bested by man and killed with his bare hands. And the last question that he takes is asking him, well, what now? You know, are you going to go and, you know, become the next Steve Irwin, travel the earth and, you know, be the mountain lion hunter? And he says an interesting thing that reminded me of the ego trap. He said two different things. The first one is this, about earning esteem in the right way.
I don't know. It's kind of weird to feel kind of famous for like an unearned reason. It's very much like a situation of happenstance where like a wrong place, wrong time, instead of an earned sort of degree of fame, I guess. So that's been pretty weird.
Yeah.
And then he goes, isn't that fascinating? You got a pretty honest hunter here.
Right.
And then he goes on to describe the weird feeling that is the ego trap that we're going to discuss today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the hardest part is I will never be able to live up to the reputation. And maybe that's what has led to some of my reticence for actually coming out, because I don't know, the story is bigger than than my puny form. So, yeah.
So with that said, Dr. Lyle, let's talk about this. Let's talk about the ego trap. Hit us with the truth.
Yes. Beautiful. What a character. You can tell he's extremely bright. And that's no unusual human right there. That's a terrific story, Nate. Good for finding it. I end up talking about the ego trap a lot with respect to diet and lifestyle changes. That's just because of where I've come from as a clinician. So many of the people that have come to me, you know, with those problems. It's not the only place that this is involved. It just turns out that it enabled me to figure out the ego trap because of the problems that people face with diet and lifestyle issues. Cause I kept seeing, it was a little bit useful. I kept seeing the same type of problem over and over again, and it helped me identify a pattern. The problem with diet and lifestyle change or anything where we're trying to make a change that's really going against instincts for addiction is similar. And that is that problem is going to be what we call the pleasure trap. So what the pleasure trap is it's since Alan Goldhammer invented the word, I can say what it means. Precisely. And what it is it's a trapping of our motivational instincts as a result into a self-destructive motivation as a result of changes in the modern environment with respect to the Stone Age environment for which those instincts were evolved. So the drugs would be the most potent example of that drug addiction. Someone is doing something self-destructive because the drugs are hyperactivating pleasure pathways in the brain, basically signaling biological success while the person is actually doing something self-destructive. Our sort of early insight, we're one of the early people to make a huge case that this was actually the problem with this was the fundamental health problem of our time. And it was primarily through eating. So people were eating a diet that was super rich and therefore more pleasure stoking than a natural diet for the reason that the basic pleasure system is designed by nature to detect calories, and it's designed to give more pleasure when the calories are of greater concentration. So we could see that the modern food supply was simply man's ingenious methods for concentrating the food supply and getting rid of fiber specifically and isolating fats out and adding them to the food and essentially turning the food into a drug-like substance that would be hyperactivating the dopamine pathway specifically. So this is, and Neil Bernard came on the scene with a similar argument about caseomorphines and essentially arguing that another big component of this was, you know, the endorphin pathway, essentially. It doesn't really matter. The point is that we're talking about the modern food supply being supernormal stimuli in the same way that drugs are supernormal stimuli. And supernormal meaning stimulation that the organism was simply never designed to experience. And it was similar experiences, but now intensified. So in the same way that if you listen to really loud rock music for a long time, you're going to do damage to your ears. You may like it, and then as the damage gets done, you can't hear as well, so you turn it on even louder and do more damage, et cetera. So you can see a cycle of self-destruction in that process. And the same thing is true of food, and the same thing is true of drug addiction. Now, that is an unnatural problem. So the pleasure trap is an unnatural problem. It's not a problem you were designed to solve. This is why so many really smart people can't solve it, because your intelligence isn't really an issue here. The people who solve it best are people that are probably very emotionally stable, highly conscientious. They don't have to be that smart. They just have to have identified the problem and not be so reactive to the stimuli that they can't back themselves away from the problem. So this is also a puzzling issue, because so many problems in life, the higher your IQ, you can solve problems that less intelligent people cannot solve, and you can solve them with ease. This is not a similar problem. This is an unnatural problem that has more to do with going into essentially neurochemical processes involved in motivation. And so that's what makes the pleasure trap a unique and particularly slippery and difficult problem to solve. Now, that's the problem that I was attempting to solve in the late 1990s and the early 2000s. And the book that Alan and I wrote called The Pleasure Trap is the story of a bit best explaining to people that the reasons why they're having a difficult problem with addictive type issues is because it's going against their instincts. The this is a different argument than you're going to see typically, or that you saw typically at the time. Typically now, if you go on The Biggest Loser, you're going to find out that, you know, they're talking about the underlying emotional issues why people are having these problems. This is the story of our time, is that, you know, people have underlying emotional psychodynamic problems that are driving these self-destructive tendencies. This is ridiculous. These problems emerged in the late 20th century in the Western world, and they emerged in humans, dogs, and cats. They didn't emerge anywhere else in the world. And so as the products of our food supply, for example, spread, now it's heading into Samoa, it's heading into China, et cetera. So we can see that these are, in fact, problems of behavioral management as associated with novel environmental problems that the organism wasn't designed to solve. That's the source of it. Now, because these are unnatural problems, and they're problems that are frustratingly puzzling with respect to particularly diligent and intelligent people. So they can't figure out why they keep failing. And so, of course, one of the things that they do is they infer that there's an underlying psychodynamic issue, their mother issues, comfort issues from their grandmother, et cetera. The interesting thing is sometimes there is an underlying self-destructive psychodynamic-like process. And that process I identified, and it's what I call the ego trap. So this is where we get a little fancier about the psychology of understanding self-destruction. And the ego trap is particularly potent with respect to pleasure trap issues, but it's also potent in its own right. So now we're going to now talk about a second self-destructive process that goes on in people. So the first one that we can identify, and that's really quite obvious if we look at it, and we're not clouded by some pretty serious misconceptions about human motivation, the pleasure trap is simply the super stoking of pleasure pathways by artificial stimulation that will cause an addictive-like response. That makes complete sense. Simple, straightforward, and very potent in its explanatory reach. However, when people attempt to simply take that information and apply it and go against what it is that they are trapped by, they find themselves sometimes in an interesting dilemma. Let's give an example of somebody who is attempting to stop smoking cigarettes. So they're in the pleasure trap. So if they try to stop smoking, they go into withdrawal. The withdrawal is uncomfortable. If they then resume the nicotine, they feel better. The nicotine stokes the dopamine pathway. So they're rewarded. It feels like they did the right thing. So all of that, we can see the trap. And if we're an intelligent person, we can see that how the trap works. And we can see what we need to do to get out of the trap, which is to enforce abstinence over a period of long enough time where the normal neurochemistry writes itself. You know, it seems simple and straightforward. The only problem is, because it's an unnatural problem, it's more difficult than we think. And it's more difficult than other people that don't have the problem think. And this is where it gets interesting. That let's suppose we're a bright, capable person and we smoke. and other people near us and around us know that we're bright and capable, and they look at this habit and they say, why don't you just stop? Since they don't have the problem, they don't know the difficulty of the task. And as a result, they are underestimating the task's difficulty, and they are overestimating the individual's ability to actually master it. And so as a result, the individual now is listening to this feedback, and they have the following problem. And that is, they are expected to be able to manage the problem, while they themselves have actually worked at the problem maybe 40 times, and they have failed consistently. So as a result, what happens is that they understand that they are being overrated. Their peers, their family, their loved ones, et cetera, whoever it is, people out there in the village actually believe that they have more chops with respect to this problem than they have. Now, this now sets the stage for what I call the ego trap. The ego trap is a natural motivational dilemma. If we believe that we have more esteem to gain by trying, and then even if we fail, we haven't lost that much, then we're very excited about the prospect. The way motivation works is it works on essentially cost-benefit analytic programs. And so the main feedback, or the ultimate feedback for these programs, is genetic survival. So it's going to turn out that gene survival is going to be tied into things like pleasurable responses, painful responses, and as well as emotional impact. So pleasant emotional responses and painful emotional responses. One of the most pleasant emotional responses that you can have is to get signals from other people that you are valuable and cool and that they're impressed by you. That means that they're more likely to mate with you, they're more likely to be your friend, and they're more likely to hire you. It turns out that if you lose regard from other people, then you are less likely for them to be willing to mate with you, less likely to be befriended, and less likely to be hired. So these are the three grand markets of human survival and reproduction, which are mating, friendship, and trade. And how other people feel about us, or what they think of us, is going to be central to the range of our opportunities with respect to those three trades. So therefore, if we do something that causes others think less of us, then this is costly. It shrinks our market, shrinks our opportunities, and reduces our likelihood of survival and reproductive success. So therefore, we're designed by nature with exquisite emotional machinery that essentially feeds back to us whether it appears we've increased our esteem from others or we've decreased it. And so this is part of the process that what I call esteem dynamics. In other words, your feeling about your life, how it is, your emotional tone in your day at any given moment, is largely, but not completely, the result of feedback that you're receiving from other people, whether or not they're sending you positive signals or they're sending you negative signals. Now, it's going to turn out that if people are sending you positive signals that say, we think you are better than what it is that you're doing, we think that you can, you know, you can put down these cigarettes, you're so smart, you're so capable, that we fully believe that you can do it, in principle, that should be a good signal. And they feel like they're sending you a positive signal. They're essentially reminding you that you've got this nasty, self-destructive, stinky habit. And they're basically telling you, hey, you're too smart for that nasty, stupid, stinky habit. Don't you know that's self-destructive? Of course you know that. So why don't you just stop it? The problem is that the people that are sending the signal are operating under a delusion. And the delusion is that it is a simple process to stop the pleasure trap and to get out of it. They themselves may not be in that particular trap, so as a result, they lack intuition about the nature of the trap, and they lack intuition about its difficulty. And as a result, they have now overrated the individual in terms of their ability to manage this trap. They may not have overrated the individual generally. In other words, the feedback that they've given that person is consistent with how it is that they feel about them generally. The problem is they've underestimated the particular slipperiness or difficulty of this particular problem, which is the pleasure trap. So it's going to turn out that the pleasure trap actually uniquely sets up the ego trap. The pleasure trap is, because it is surprisingly difficult and we have a lack of intuition about its difficulty, it sets up the ego trap all over the place. So let's, for example, let's take a woman who's 40 years old and who's 30 or 40 pounds overweight, and she's highly intelligent and capable and conscientious. Okay. The rest of her world says, hey, Sarah, you know, why don't you just go on a diet, do Weight Watchers, do this, do that. They've got all kinds of advice for her, all of her thin friends and her thin mother. Okay. And they all believe that, hey, this is not a problem. What do? You just do Atkins for a little while, or, you know, just go on Weight Watchers, or, hey, just do Slim Fast. So they've got no end of advice for this individual who they believe is fully capable of beating this problem. The problem is that the people that are giving the advice do not understand the problem. They don't understand that the problem is the pleasure trap, and that the pleasure trap is an unnatural problem that shows no respect for how beautiful, how intelligent, how wealthy, or any other of your life advantages. Pleasure trap is an insidious, nasty, hidden force of an interaction between the modern environment and Stone Age circuits that were designed for an environment of scarcity. So as a result of this, our highly intelligent, conscientious, motivated human is in the ego trap, because the friends and family and boyfriend all think that she should just be able to handle this problem. And it turns out they are not handling the problem. They are not staying out of the corn chips and corn dogs and pizza. They just think that they have the ability to somehow push themselves away from the table in time, and they go to the gym and they do yoga. So that's why it is that they're thin. That's not why they're thin. They're thin as a result of natural genetic variation that visits people differently with respect to this specific characteristic. Okay. I can imagine dark-skinned people looking at white-skinned people in Panama and saying, come on, you just got to like get with it. You don't need to be sunburned. Don't have your sun turn red like that. Just don't do it. Okay, this is similar. So the thin people have no clue that they are every bit as pleasure trapped by these same instincts as everybody else. It just turns out that people that are having weight problems wear the pleasure trap on them. Almost no thin people, less than 1% of the thin people you'll ever see, have earned their thinness through any intelligent diligence about their diet and lifestyle. 99%+ of any thin person that you will ever see in your life, any of the thin people, they are all the result of eating the same diet as the overweight people are eating, except that they are eating it in quantities that are being regulated by hunger drives and by metabolism differences that result in them remaining slender. They are not earning it through any kind of execution of behavior against the pleasure trap. Now, but they don't know this. They're completely oblivious. They're like fish in water, and they have no idea what water is. So the thin people have no idea what it's like to get out of the pleasure trap because they've never done it. And so when our overweight person attempts to do this, they find great difficulty in it, and they slip like a rat trying to get out of a greased bowl, can't get out of it. Okay, it's very difficult to do. However, the entire social environment says, come on, Sarah. So, I mean, it's important. You know, look at your dating life. You know, your boyfriend's thinking about leaving you. He's not that interested, whatever. Okay. There's no end to subtle feedback about this issue, or not so subtle. You know, her dad takes her aside and says, you know, kid, you really ought to take care of this. It's like, well, thanks a lot. It's not like the person doesn't know. Okay. So the problem is that they are firmly in the ego trap. The expectations are that they should be able to handle this problem. They have attempted to handle the problem 187 times, and they have almost always failed, often not completely. So by gritting down the hunger drive for a while, eating less pizza and oranges, and now what they do is they lose a little bit of weight, and they think, God, that's how it's supposed to be done, huh? it turns out they don't have the right solution. And even if they have the right solution and they actually listen to a Neil Barnard or a Colin Campbell or John McDougall or an Alan Goldhammer, if they do that and they get it right, the problem is that even doing that is very difficult. Tell them to join a group like Chef AJ, try to get some more support. It's still difficult, okay? So as a result, what happens is that the person is having great difficulty, but the world expects them to execute. So this is the ego trap. They think that you're supposed to be able to do it. You find out that you're having a very difficult time. It's going to turn out that if you continue to struggle and you struggle obviously, then what people will do is they will judge, they will make judgments that they have actually overrated your general competence. And that they will say, huh, you're not as together as I thought you were. Maybe you've got underlying emotional problems that I didn't know about. There's more chaos inside of your nervous system than I thought. I was walking with a friend of mine, psychologist, we worked together, and an overweight psychologist walked by, and my friend said, you know what, he must have some really serious issues to carry that extra weight. Yeah. And I didn't clarify to my friend that he completely was off base. He's a practicing psychologist, have no clue as to what it is that he's looking at and inferring what everybody else infers, that the weight is the result of an underlying problem, which is exactly what they promote on something like The Big Loser and everywhere else.
Skinny people obviously don't have any problems at all, right?
Right. They don't have any emotional problems at all. Okay. So here's the problem. So you can see how easy this is to set up the ego trap. The ego trap takes place when your ego or your esteem meter, your device that is picking up cues about how much other people value you. This device basically senses that other people think more highly of you and have higher expectations for you than you have for yourself. The expectations you have for yourself are generally quite realistic. In other words, you actually have made a lot of attempts and you have failed. So nothing irritated me more than my cool, good-looking friend saying, hey, that's no problem, man. Yeah, you just got to go up to the girls and talk to them. Like, really? Yeah, well, I've tried that about 17 times, and I'm 0 for 17. So don't tell me, okay? So this is the ego trap, and it's a brutal place to be living when other people's expectations are unrealistically high and you know that they are wrong. Under those circumstances, there is one most intelligent move on the chessboard. This is engineered by natural selection. The right move is to not try. That is the correct move. The correct move is to not try and be obvious that we are not trying. The reason is that if it's obvious that we are not trying, then when we fail, which we will, then the others that are observing us will say, well, the reason you're failing is you're not trying. Of course you could do it if you tried, but because you're not trying, that's why you're failing. That's kind of a weird thing that you're doing there, Sarah, by not trying. But you're not trying, okay? And in this way, Sarah maintains some component of her esteem, despite the fact that she continues to fail and have negative consequences for this competitive problem. This is the ego trap, okay? The ego trap takes place whenever the cost benefit of attempting to try and failing is overshadowed by the loss that you could have if you're observed to fail. So we want people, and people are normally in a situation where if they do their very best and they fall short of expectations, it's not too much of a problem. However, from time to time, in Stone Age environments and in the modern environment, what can happen and did happen is that occasionally people had an unusually lucky streak, or for some strange reason, circumstances, they were overrated. And the and this is a, our mountain lion story is a great example of this. So this situation happens, and then suddenly this guy's overrated. And you know, the interesting thing about this character, this character is very sophisticated psychologically, and he recognized the absurdity of the attention that he was getting and the inferences people were making about him, about the story. And he showed unusual grace in how it is that he was going to make sure that he didn't sit inside that ego trap, because that was, it would be an absurd place to live. The, but that, you know, that same type of thing can happen all over the place with people. And it happens every day. Every competent, overweight person has this problem. Every alcoholic has this problem. Every drug addict has this problem. Everybody trying to stop cigarettes has this problem. Every student that has been told by their parents that they're brilliant, that they're a genius, every coach that said that you're going to be a star, the people are well-meaning in attempting to heap adulation and praise on children, other adults, et cetera, and predict great things for them. Probably this is in the best interest of the person doing it, because they get credit in that, in the talented person's coalition, for being the first to call it, to be the first to see. Okay. The, so I believe that there's an evolutionary adaptation that says, if you think there's someone with talent, call it early. Okay. Call it early and call it loud, because that way you called it before others. And so when that person rises in the world, as you expect that they will remember you for the person who saw their greatness before it became more widely evident. This is a this is independent of the fact that parents are trying to tell the village how great their children are, how great their genes are, et cetera. So there's a lot of reasons why the ego trap would spontaneously arise in Stone Age environments. 30 years ago, there was a young man who got, you know, I mean, this happens on a daily basis. So I just remember this one incident. There was a terrific young basketball player at Temple University. He decided to go play for Don Chaney. And he was like a gift. He was an absolute top-level recruit that's just decided he liked Don Chaney, and he was going to go play for him. Chaney didn't even have to recruit him hard. He just dropped out of the sky into Temple. His name was Mark Macon, and he was fabulous. He was 6 foot 6 inches, terrific athlete, great shooter. He had it all. And Billy Packer, there was a – the really, God, I forget who the announcer is. He's March Madness crazy guy. Gosh, I'm sorry, I'm bulking on his name. I'm blocking. He's a super high energy, super excited character. The number one commentator of March Madness for the last 30 years.
I got nothing. My basketball trivia sucks.
What this guy did, and Dick Vitale. His name is Dick Vitale, very well-named character, super vital character. Dick Vitale, I think, is a great guy. But he did something that he shouldn't have done. And that is, he went overboard in praising Mark Macon. And he said, this guy's the second coming of Oscar Robertson. He just couldn't keep his mouth shut. Okay? This created a tremendous ego trap for Macon. And Macon went out and had a miserable quarterfinal in the NCAA tournament. You know, was really embarrassed. And he went on, he struggled along, got to the NBA, where he belonged for a while. He had a modest NBA career for several years, but nothing special. This was not the second coming of Oscar Robertson. You know, so although that might have felt amazing if you're Mark Macon at the time, to have someone of that stature saying that about you, it wasn't true. And Vitale had no business saying this. And so how much psychological misery he caused in that young man for years as that praise echoed around his entire life. Okay? So those of you that think that you want to praise your children and build up their, you know, what do you think we're doing? Their self-esteem? No. It's not touching their self-esteem. Their self-confidence? No. It's not actually impacting their self-confidence. It will very, very temporarily until the evidence indicates that you're wrong. And then what you've done is you put them in an ego trap. So the ego trap can be a very substantive major force as people's cost-benefit analytics run the numbers. And it basically says, hey, if I've got more esteem to lose than I have to gain, then I'm not going to try. There's probably no more potent recurring generator of the ego trap than the pleasure trap. And that's because there's probably no problem in human achievement that is so misunderstood than the pleasure trap. So so as a result, the social environments that people have are consistently generating expectations for people that are struggling with the pleasure trap that are inconsistent with the realities of actually facing it and dealing with it. And as a result, what we wind up with is people that are constantly quitting. They try a little bit and they quit. And then they try a little bit again sometime and they quit. And then they suffer in the misery that as a result of the lack of achievement with respect to the problem, whether it's alcohol, cigarettes, some kind of drug addiction, or it's food and weight issues. And then they suffer for a while longer, and then their natural competitive instincts say, you know what? My life's going down the tubes. I need to do something about it. And they roll up their shirt sleeves, go on, you know, listen to a seminar, read a book, and try again. Okay? They face the ego trap again, and then what happens? They fail very often. And as a result of this, then they crawl into their hole, and they die for a while, and we don't see them again for a while. This is how this works. So the pleasure trap being a spectacular generator of the ego trap, these two things together wind up as a very potent mixture of human self-destruction. It's also interesting to note that the pleasure trap and the ego trap are actually, in a bizarre fashion, they are opponent processes. And that is that if we, let's say, for example, that the that we're attempting to stop a drinking problem. The world says, come on, just push yourself away. Just put down the bottle, throw it away, as if that decision is that simple. The problem is that if we actually set the bar at a level of achievement that would be an awful lot more reasonable. For example, I'll tell you what, let's cut down your alcohol use by 10% in the next month. And then we'll cut it down by 10% the next month and 10% the next month and 10% the next month. And then after 10 months, we'll have the problem solved. That would be a reasonable goal for any other kind of problem. If you're attempting to, you know, I don't know, learn how to juggle, you'd start one step at a time and take one little piece at a time. And by successive approximations, we would move towards a more complicated and more outstanding achievement. That's how we learn anything. That's how people learn to walk, and that's how they learn to talk, through exactly that process. The problem is that the ego trap actually causes its own problem. Excuse me, the pleasure trap. Pleasure trap actually causes its own problem. So if you drink, you actually stoke the problem itself. So really the correct place to go with respect to something like alcoholism is to go to complete abstinence. But complete abstinence is an unbelievable achievement. It's a tremendous leap. And so if that's the expectation, it's exceedingly likely that people will fail. So this is why this is a problem. The lower you put the bar with respect to the pleasure trap, the more easy it would be for a person to reach that goal, i.e. it gets them out of the ego trap. However, it keeps them in the pleasure trap, and the pleasure trap itself is a devastating noose. If we put the goal very, very high, in order to get the person out of the pleasure trap, i.e. abstinence from alcohol. The problem is we've almost certainly walked them into the ego trap, because when they look at that mountain, they're like, well, I can't climb that mountain. I've tried to climb that mountain 170 times and I can't do it. And so what do they tell you? I'll start tomorrow. Okay. So procrastination and despair wind up being the recurrent hallmarks of the ego trap. And they are particularly present with respect to pleasure trap problems. So what's the solution? The solution to the ego trap, with or without the pleasure trap being the generating mechanism, the solution is actually to pay very close attention to the fundamentals. And whatever those fundamentals are, our job is to set up incremental, small, positive movements and to set those as daily expectations. So these aren't vague, okay? They're actually highly specific. So for example, if we were trying to quit smoking cigarettes, we could absolutely do this incrementally. So if we're trying to get out off of, you know, morphine use, we could do it incrementally. If we're doing an alcohol, believe it or not, you can do it incrementally. It isn't necessarily the only way to do it, but it is a way that you can do it. So, and certainly with respect to processed foods, et cetera, you can do this. And with respect to any other ego trap, you can do it. So let's suppose you have writer's block because people think that you're a great writer and because you've done something very well in the past. And now you can't get yourself to write. So this is what writer's block is. Writer's block isn't some magical process that happens to writers. It's the ego trap. Okay? The ego trap is essentially saying the expectations from others are so high that you know that you are very unlikely to meet those expectations. So the right thing is to do nothing. And as long as you do nothing, and we can call it writer's block, then other people say, oh my God, you know, Sarah is a brilliant writer. She's got writer's block. So someday she will be unblocked maybe and we'll see her brilliance again. But right now she's got writer's block. Okay. And so that's what writer's block is the motivational system of the mind running a cost-benefit analysis on whether it's worth actually putting the energy in and winding up with a result that is beneath the expectation of others. So what do we do? What we do is we change the focus as best we can for how it is that we're earning esteem and from whom. So the way we are generally attempting to earn esteem is by doing great things and having great results so that other people can see them. That is the esteem-seeking process of humans. So the lady that needs to lose 40 pounds wants to lose 40 pounds and then have other people say, oh my gosh, now you look great. Okay? That's what she wants. That's what she's thinking about. That's what she's dreaming about. That's what she's scheming for. Because when that happens, those are the esteem signals from her environment that are actually where the rubber hits the road in evolution. That's when it changes men's or women's mating decisions. It's where it is that it changes friendship decisions. It's where it changes hiring decisions. So therefore, that's what she wants. That's what she's focused on. However, I will argue that that's the wrong place to put your focus. The right place to put your focus to beat the ego trap, whether the ego trap is involved in the pleasure trap or not, the right place to put your focus is actually on a different device inside your mind that we're going to call the internal audience. The internal audience is a bizarre feature of human psychology. It's an internal set of social psychological neural circuits. It acts as if they are real people and they are watching you. And they're watching you when other people aren't watching, or sometimes when they are watching, but particularly when they're not. And they're watching you take action and in the preparation for your displays of other people. So, for example, your internal audience is watching you when you've got your calculus book open and you are diligently working on your calculus problems and your homework, okay? And when you're done after 2 hours and you've worked very hard, your internal audience essentially signals to you that it respects your very hard work. And that's a feeling of the essentially an audience signaling your esteem meter. And the source of, or the resultant feeling is going to be what we call pride. Okay? That's where pride comes from. Pride is a specific emotional experience that comes from the internal audience signaling the esteem meter as if other people were watching and saying, boy, can I respect what you just did. That's what the internal audience will do. If the person knows that they should study for 2 hours and they only study for half an hour and they decide to go leave and go to a concert, the internal audience is aware of this. And the internal audience says, hey, you're kind of a flake. Okay? And it gives them an internal signal of self-disgust. Earned. Okay? Turns out on the cover of Psychology Today for April 2019 is some, the very cover of it says, I had something, 9 ways to talk back to your internal critic. Internal critic is what I'm calling the internal audience. It's the term that came out of cognitive therapy. And so we're talking about the same device, but we have a very different view of what that device is and how it works. So if you look at their little prescriptions of how to, quote, talk back to the internal critic, you'll see that the internal critic is largely viewed as an annoyance. It's largely viewed as some pesky thing that gets in the way of human happiness, okay? It's not. It's a beautiful construction of human evolution to help you be more competitive with respect to your survival and reproductive problems in terms of advertising what your value proposition is to other people in terms of mates, friends, and trade. Can you imagine an internal audience that when you look in the mirror every time, it just says, oh, you look fabulous just the way you are? What good would that be? You need an internal audience that says, whoa, that doesn't look so good. Change this. Wait a second. Try a different hat. Wait a second. Try a different this. Ooh, you've got hair coming out your nose. Get out the tweezers. Your internal audience is there to help you by actually looking at what it is that you can be doing that will make your advertisement to others more competitive. Your internal audience knows intuitively that a great many achievements take a lot of effort. And so if you have something standing between you and causing you to be far more competitive or effective in the world, then it knows that it's not going to be simple. Now, believe me, simpler people and more gullible and open people and less conscientious people go to a seminar that tells them all you got to do is think big thoughts and believe, and then things will manifest. Well, nothing will manifest out of such things other than continued failure. It's going to turn out that success in any endeavor is going to be the result of addressing the fundamental issues, the talents, abilities, resources, et cetera, skills that are necessary in order to be more competitive. So if that means, for example, losing weight, then it means addressing the specific fundamentals that are associated with weight loss, which means executing on the diet that is going to get you out of the pleasure trap. And your job is to do that. And if you can't do it perfectly, then you should be doing it 80%. Do it better than you've been doing it at the present, and set a daily set of goals about what it is that you're going to do. And that may not, that those goals don't have to include perfection. If you're trying to study calculus, it doesn't mean that you have to get every problem right or understand actually everything that went wrong and the problems you didn't understand. The deal is, did you make a very good, diligent effort? That's what you need to do. The question might be, how good of an effort do you have to make? And the answer is, enough for your internal audience to be proud of you. That's what you need to do. So if you do that, you can check it, because the system, when you stop putting in your efforts, the system will say, that was well done. That was good enough. Well done. We move on to something else now. If the system doesn't tell you that, then it expects that you are leaving it short, that you're not actually doing a good enough job, and it will not give you the pride. Okay. Somehow, for some reason, people think that you should be able to have that kind of pride as a result of, I don't know, hypnotism, thinking big fancy thoughts, etc. You don't. It's not going to do it for you. What's going to happen is that when people make the what I call micro goal efforts, the little things that you actually do every day that are a component of an overall scheme in order to ultimately improve. When you do those little things, your internal audience watches you, and it will change how it feels depending upon what it is that you do. If you do a mediocre job, it'll give you mediocre feedback. That's fair. It's a coach. It's telling you, hey, you didn't work very hard today. If you work very hard today and do a very good job, it'll say, hey, well done. It'll pat you on the back and nod. That's what it will do. If you work extremely hard, it will actually bow. It will say, outstanding. Okay, but it won't give you that for nothing. It doesn't give those trophies away for free. So the correct place to put our focus is actually understanding that that feeling that we have about ourselves is dynamic. This is not well understood. It's not well understood by psychology, even at a sophisticated level, and it's certainly not understood by pop psychology, and it's utterly not understood by people in the culture at large. This, the esteem process, this is what I call the self-esteem mechanism, which is the internal audience's signal to the esteem meter. This mechanism is highly dynamic. It's dynamic enough to change that if you are, for example, an overweight person, if she went to the gym for, 75 minutes and worked very hard, it would change. It would shift. Okay? If she made one decision, which she normally then, even when she does that, she goes and has a cheese quesadilla because she felt like she deserved it, and she doesn't do that and instead goes home and eats a bunch of steamed vegetables and some rice, it's going to turn out that her internal audience will be shifting. Okay? Now, it won't be giving her a standing ovation, but it will be giving her positive feedback. And if she pays attention to it, she can feel it. And the more she does this from day after day, it's going to turn out that it's going to dial up how it is that it feels. That it will be more consistent from day to day, that she will be having a good feeling about herself. She can feel the momentum. And what will happen is, if she's executing the proper fundamentals, she'll start to get something else, which is that she'll get objective evidence that she's improving. Just like a kid who wants to learn how to play the guitar. If that kid actually sits down and works on his scales, it's going to turn out that he's going to find objective evidence that he's improving. And that objective evidence can be very important in increasing a person's confidence that they're on the right track. Now you see what happens, that that now we have essentially replaced the sensitivity to other people's feedback and their expectations instead with an internal audience's judgment of the diligence of your effort. If we do that and we pay attention, we're going to find out that we have control, though it's indirect, over how it is that we feel about ourselves. So even though it's not as potent and as loud as the feelings that come within us as a result of feedback from other people on the outside, a compliment from the right person or negative feedback from the right person can be very impactful on our emotional life for the negative or the positive. That is true. There's nothing as important as feedback from other people in terms of its intensity on your emotional experience. But we are not in control of those things. We're only in control of our self-esteem mechanism. And of that, we're actually in complete control. The control is bizarre. It's not a control that you can dictate and that you can will through self-talk. That won't do anything. The control that we have is through the efforts that we make at the literal actions that are integrated towards us solving a problem and becoming more competitive. if we do those things and we are diligent and we put in good effort, our self-esteem mechanism will fire regard. It will cause pride, and it will do it literally today. Okay. The most important thing in the ego trap is to actually understand that, of course, you are overwhelmed and stuck. You have expectations from others that are too high. They are intimidating you into making any efforts at all, and they cause a recurrent procrastination and despair. Doesn't matter what the nature of the ego trap is, though it's particularly devastating when it's about pleasure trap problems. However, if we dial back the problem into not focused on the day of our grand achievement and our positive feedback from others, and instead we become more sensitive observers of our own internal experience, and we look for the connection between our diligent effort at fundamentals on an hourly basis and how it is that we feel about ourselves as a result of that effort, if we pay attention to that, then it's going to turn out that we have an amazing amount of control over the emotional content of our life. That's what people need to understand. So this is the story of the ego trap is really the story of the changing of our focus from how much esteem we're winning on the outside world versus how much esteem that we earn from the inside. And if we get addicted to that process where we like that feeling of being morally right with ourselves and doing an excellent job as we continue to make diligent progress towards a worthwhile goal, then one day we're going to find that we will have traveled a long ways. And we may not have gotten to the place that we wanted to get to, but wherever we got to, it's going to turn out that there will be a great deal of satisfaction with whatever that achievement is. So this is, this has echoes of Buddhism in it, you know, process, not outcome. John Wooden, process, not outcome, not caring about winning. We care about the peace of mind that comes with knowing that we did the best job that we could. That's the notion. And this is what it is that we want to do to solve these type of problems, which wind up collectively, the ego trap and the pleasure trap wind up being, you know, probably the major motivational dilemmas of our time. So that's why we look at these things together as well as separately and understand their dynamics and understand the important issue winds up being amazingly simple in that the idea is to break down something that is daunting into small parts and then start working on it on essentially a minute to minute, an hour to hour basis, and watch our internal experience change as the result of our excellent efforts. So that's how it works, Nathan.
It's simple, but not easy.
Right. Exactly. And once you understand it, this is why you will find that once people get on a roll, they can do spectacular things in terms of changing their life around, because they get essentially on a self-reinforcing cycle of earning the self-esteem, and then they fall in love with that process.
Absolutely fascinating. Well, Dr. Lyle, thank you for explaining the ego trap. Next time we talk, we'll go over some actual pinpointed questions about it and see if we can kind of weave through people's thinking and help them out of these ego traps.
Fantastic.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.